Hello and welcome to the first part of our special episode of Short Story Hunters. And I'm here with Johnny. Hi, Johnny.
Hi, Bea. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm quite excited about this.
Me too, yeah. Looking forward to this one.
Tell our readers.
Well, we've been to see our special guest for these two episodes, Peter Laws, the Reverend Peter Laws, who's the author of the very much acclaimed Matt Hunter books.
He's also a podcaster as well, like us, and he does the Creepy Cove Community Church podcast.
Yeah, now that is something you want to check that out. You really do.
It is quite different, isn't it? It's not what you expect.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And we went to meet him and had a very long, interesting chat, didn't we?
We talked about everything under the sun, almost.
We did, and we did it all on hot water and coffee.
Yeah, we should have asked him about hot water. We didn't canvas his views on that.
No, but I suppose he's a reverend as well, isn't he? So he's probably more into holy water.
He might be, or communion wine or something like that.
Oh yeah. You could do a holy spritzer, couldn't you? Community wine,
yes,
holy water, and you get a holy spritzer.
Yeah, sounds like something somebody from the 50s. But holy spritzer, Batman. Anyway, we digress as usual.
We do, but we're going to bring you two special episodes. The first half is today, and then we will release the second half in a few weeks' time, a couple of weeks or so.
He was kind enough to meet us in the Lit Lounge, and we're going to join the conversation there.
And you're a musician as well, aren't you, Peter?
Yes, not a particularly great one, but I've always wanted to be a composer when I was a teenager. That's the kind of the creativity I wanted to explore, but then I ended up joining bands and doing that sort of stuff. And then eventually I ended up writing, and that became the creative outlet. But what's good about the podcast I do now, which is the Creepy Cove Community Church podcast, is that it involves music as well. So it's basically... Mm. I don't know if you've heard of it before.
Yes, we've listened. Listened. We both listened, haven't we?
Oh, fantastic. So it's got like sort of gothic hymns in and weird music. And so it gives me an opportunity to, you know, mess around and come up with music. And I do that sort of thing alongside all the strange, spooky things. So, yeah, it's a nice combination.
Presumably you're all the voices in that as well, Peter. Yeah.
Yeah, I did that not because I'm not a good actor by any stretch, but I started this during lockdown. Because all of the author events started getting cancelled, obviously. And I decided to do this podcast. And actually, I thought, well, it's going to be so tricky to try and get other people in to do voices for this. So if I just put on a stupid voice, I'll try it and then manage to get away with it. So,
works really well. I like your... I can't recall your name, but you're sort of... Your narrator, the fellow who talks like this.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, all that works really well.
All that is just putting on a stereotypical posh voice and then reducing the pitch a couple of notches. It sounds like slightly somebody else.
Yes, it reminds me, funny enough, it reminds me, and you're probably not going for it, but it reminds me a little bit of Richard Coles, you know, the Reverend Richard Coles.
Oh, right, yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, the overall sound of it, but it's really wacky. The podcast is really, really, really interesting.
Yeah, great fun. What's strange about the podcast is that it's designed to be fun, but also to encourage people. And I've just been amazed at the amount of messages I'm getting about that show of people saying, I don't go to church, I'm not into this God stuff, but this is helping me. Me and my wife are thinking about getting divorced, and then your episode on relationships is helping us stick together, and all this sort of stuff for people who, you know, they may be atheists, Christians, some are Satanists, some are witches, but they just they seem comfortable like going to this creepy gothic church because it's fictional, and yet the things they're saying sound like the sort of things that people were telling me when I was speaking in a normal church, you know, afterwards.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting kind of model I've not actually seen done before, but
It's really different. We were both saying too that the strap line we've seen somewhere, I think it might be on a tweet,
Stephen King one, yeah.
Yeah, a mashup between Songs of Praise and Stephen King's
book. That's it.
Fabulous.
That's the quickest way to describe it.
I tell you what, let's hear a sample from your podcast.
Good evening, and welcome to another Creepy Cove Community Church service here in the haunted, mysterious fishing town of Creepy Cove, where all horror movies actually happened. Do find a seat, and a special welcome to anybody listening at home through the marvelous podcast medium. As always, tonight's service will feature gothic hymns, eerie prayers, and a genuine sermon to encourage you, led by our minister, Peter Laws, who is with me right now. Peter, are you really an actual church minister?
I am, Rupert. I'm ordained and everything, and I've loved spooky things and horror movies my whole life.
Oh, gosh, well, you fit right in here.
Thank you.
So, Peter, what would you say is the point of Creepy Cove?
Well, it's a church for everyone, no matter what their beliefs are. It's a safe space to have an immersive experience of a non-judgmental church, as long as they don't mind the odd vampire or ghost sitting next to them.
Indeed. Though it's not completely safe, is it, Padre? The third toilet cubicle in our lavatory facilities is still demonically possessed. Best avoid. Well, do grab a seat, everybody, and if you're visiting from the comfort of home, remember, you can attend the church anytime you wish via our trendy podcast function. Subscribe for free this very night, and may we all find a little hope amongst the horror.
What is happening, Lord?
Fantastic. And that's what you can expect if you tune into the Creepy Cove Community Church. And as Rupert said, look out for the demonic possession in cubicle 3 of the wash facilities. That was really great, Peter. We really enjoyed that. But what got you into religion then? How come you started? You're an ordained minister, aren't you? A Baptist minister?
Yes, yes, my child. Sorry, we're going into the... Yeah, yeah, I was actually really antagonistic and irritated and annoyed by organized religion, and especially Christianity, up until my early 20s. So I really was thought of as the person who would be most likely to become a devil worshipper, because I was really into horror and supernatural. And I used to give Christians such a hard time. I was quite a nice person, really, unless a Christian was in the room. My RE teacher, for example, I would be quite odious to those people. I wasn't really sure why. And then at university, it was just there when I start asking some of the bigger questions. What causes the universe to exist? These sorts of things. What happens when we die? And I think that just started me thinking. But then what I was shocked to find is I actually met some Christians. And I'd never really met normal Christians before. I'd only seen stereotypical versions on TV. Mm. Harold Bishop from Neighbours, Doc Cotton from EastEnders. Not exactly the role models I wanted to become. I was very shocked to find scientists and lecturers and people who I felt really had a brain, and yet they were able to hold this idea of faith in cohesion with rationality. And I was like, I've never seen that before. Anyway, it's a long story, but I ended up becoming a Christian and trying it out, as it were, and it really made a huge difference to my life. But I'm not one of those kind of Bible thumping type Christians who is the evangelist who thinks I need to convert everybody. I'm quite open-minded, but yeah, I found it to be a very helpful resource for me.
And do you have a Sunday service yourself, or do you, I mean, does your sort of work involve preaching to a congregation outside of the podcast, or?
Sometimes, although at the moment I work for the I used to work, but I'm ordained with the Baptist Union of Great Britain, and so I'm still like accredited to them. But they started to see like other opportunities were opening for me, and so they seconded me to do all of this weird stuff. So I do all of this strange stuff, writing and podcasting and whatnot. I'm really self-employed, so I do that, and I occasionally speak at churches. Yeah. But I'm not looking after a church like I was before this. I'm not the pastor of an actual church anyway, because I didn't have enough time to do the various events and writing stuff when I was looking after a congregation. So I'm really enjoying being a sort of Footloose and Fancy Free.
Yeah, it's quite a roving remit. It's great, you know, great
it
fun.
Is. Yeah, I mean, I go to a church, you know, I'm a member of a church. Like, I'll go be in the crowd for a church, and then sometimes speak at various churches. But yeah, it's been a while since I've been the pastor of any other church than this weird fictional one.
How did the writing start? What was the sort of route to writing books?
That started when I was a full-time minister, and my wife and I were walking in a field one day, and I looked across, and I think I saw a cow. Or something. I can't remember what it was. It was something inspiring, and for some reason, like, an idea popped in my head for a story, and that had happened before, but on this occasion, I decided, you know what, I'm gonna have a go home and maybe write out a plot for this, and that just started to grow and grow. And eventually, a few months later, I'd finished a book, and I decided I didn't want to self-publish. I thought, I want to kind of go the old-fashioned route, see if I can get an agent and all that sort of thing. Mm. So I dove into that and sent it out to agents and had a few rejections, but then amazingly got an agent who took me on and said they found it compelling, and I was amazed. And I'd read in all of the magazines, the writing magazines, advice that was saying, actually, it's so hard to get an agent. Sometimes it's harder to get an agent than get a publishing deal. So I just assumed, well, I've done the hard bit. Now it's time to waltz into Penguin Books and sign my contract. Yeah. And then actually, a few years after getting an agent, I just got that these books were getting rejected and rejected, and then so I actually changed agents at the end. When I got a new agent, we ended up getting a book deal. So it was a two book deal for fiction, but then also a non-fiction book deal, because when I thought I wasn't going to get a deal for fiction, as a backup, I thought, oh well, I'll come up with a non-fiction proposal and send that out, because obviously fiction's never going to work. And then they both came in within the space of a few months, so that was a busy year, writing a non-fiction book and a fiction book at the same time.
Yeah, I bet it was.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Yeah, but it was fun, because that took me to Transylvania. That was that was great.
Yeah, that was, I think I read that, I was doing a little bit of reading about it yesterday, I think, and am I getting this mixed up, or is part of your book a guy coming up to the sort of airport check-in, and... That's the start of the new book, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, that's it, yeah, good.
Yeah, that's the start of the non-fiction book, The Frighteners, Why We Love Monsters, Ghosts, Death and Gore.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was me trying to explain and defend why human culture has a morbid streak.
Yeah.
Because people ask me that all the time, particularly with me having a kind of religious sort of element. They're like, well, how could you possibly justify watching films with zombies eating people's heads off and claim to be a bastion of the light? And this book was supposed to be like a quite an in-depth but a fun Louis Theroux style romp.
Well, I would like to kind of know, do you really know a woman who keeps a coffin in her front room, really?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
You do? Does she still have it in her front room now?
Well, I actually saw some pictures of her front room recently, and I didn't see the coffin, but her front room looks like... It's amazing. So it's just filled with like gothic ephemera, but things from old circuses and creepy pictures of Vincent Price and Boris Karloff, and it's
oh,
quite
wow.
stunning. I can't imagine the dusting issues, but the actual aesthetically, it's very impressive. But I didn't actually see the coffin there, so I wonder if she's put that in the bathroom or something. I don't know if it's not.
Bathes in it, maybe.
Yeah.
Fills it with water and has a bath.
But it's true though. I mean, she was showing me these pictures, and I was shocked to see that she had this coffin, which is meant for her when she died.
Well, you've just answered my question. That was what I was thinking. Is this for future use?
Yes. Yeah. Her boyfriend made it for her. And I was like, wow, you need to call social services, man.
Yeah.
But no, she...
Time to get out of that relationship, man.
Yeah, exactly. But it was very fascinating, because she was showing me this, and I was looking at her like, I was like, this is weird, this is wrong, this is a kind of a bit sinister. Mm. And she said something I never forgot, which was like, don't think you're the weird one. because death is real. It's an aspect of our lives, and you're the one who is trying to pretend it doesn't exist. I'm the one who is embracing reality and seeing the positive side of it. And I find myself a much more balanced person, getting the best out of life now, knowing that it won't last forever. And so it was like, you know, that is quite interesting. And that's some of the discoveries that I made along the way when I started writing the book properly, to find out some of the reasons why people are drawn to this sort of morbid stuff. It's not because necessarily they're bad people or dangerous. In fact, it's often the opposite.
Yeah, they want to understand it, I think. He's trying to get a grip on what it means and how.
That's right. And with me, it's also about trying to get mastery over my own fears, because I find death, suffering, and violence distress. You know, some people think because I write crime fiction that has gruesome murders in it, or I like horror, that if I'm watching the news and I see a news report of some guy who gets stabbed in a nightclub, that I'm like sitting there rubbing my knees, going, "Oh, I love this sort of stuff." it's the complete polar opposite. It's like that disturbs me. So what I do instead, and I do what I think we've been doing through our human culture, is I take the kind of the furniture of which scares me and disturbs me, and I get control over it by putting it into patterns, predictable patterns, through writing or through watching genre films, generic films. And that's a psychological technique that I think many of us use. And without it, we may struggle.
Yeah, it's like putting it in a cupboard, isn't it? And understanding it and putting it away. And this is where it is, and this is where it's safe.
Yes, yeah.
Kind of that kind of feeling.
And repeatedly telling yourself like that, it's death and violence in many ways is so chaotic. And that's why it's so scary. And that's why it's so disturbing. And so we immerse ourselves into stories which, frankly, are quite predictable. You know, like if you were to look at all the crime fiction books or the horror books, and I've lost count of the amount of horror films I've watched and reviewed where, you know, a couple are driving in their car and they break down outside of a spooky old mansion and they go inside, or a body is found and they try to work out who the killer is, and oh my goodness, it's somebody else. And it's totally generic with occasional splashes of originality. But while some people would call that negative, actually there's a positivity in that. What we're doing as a culture, I think, is addressing the most fearful things, but in predictable patterns. And that has a surprisingly soothing effect. And you see this with children after 9/11. I read about this in the book, because there's a chapter in the book all about children and the dark side, and whether or not they should be shielded from scary stories. And after 9/11, children whose parents had been killed in the Twin Towers specifically, they were witnessed building Lego towers and Lego planes and smashing them into them over and over again. And understandably, of course, people around them, carers, and friends, were saying, "You've got to stop doing this. Like, this is trivializing a real event. It's weird. It's morbid." And sometimes they would do it without emotion. They would just do it over and over. But the child psychologist stepped in and said, "Do not stop them doing that. Do you realize the chaos they've just been plunged into? They cannot make sense of this. And how could you expect it? And they're kids. They can't articulate their feelings. But what they can do is take that which was terrifying and chaotic and put it into a pattern. And that can be really soothing." So I think it's a complex subject, but it's definitely not your classic black and white thinking that you'll hear in the news often. Which is this violent culture turns us into violent people.
Can we hear an extract of Matt Hunter?
This is a reading from my latest novel called Possessed, which features the character Matt Hunter in his fourth adventure. Here he is drawn into the world of demonic possession, so-called, and murder. And it all gets pretty intense. But the book starts, it opens with a milkman who discovers something very unsettling in a greenhouse when he's doing his rounds in the morning. So I thought I'd read to you a little bit from that. We pick up the story as the milkman has been introduced. We get to know him a little bit, and then let's get to the action. He slid out through the doorless gap and let his soft tread soles kiss the pavement good morning. He tugged his white coat into place and tapped his white peaked cap too, just for the hell of it. So what if he looked like a relic? He did number 78 first, the Hakim's, two semi-skimmed and an orange juice. He set the bottles down on the doorstep and gave a gentle, friendly tip of the cap to the window above. Mr. and Mrs. Hakim would be warm under their duvets right now, faces and lips pressed against marshmallow pillows. Dream on, my friends, he smiled, dream on. Back at the van, he grabbed the next crate. His heart sank a little. The Bensons lived at number 81, just across the road. Mr. Benson was a grumpy old goat who was not impressed when his wife signed up for a delivery last week. He remembered how Mr. Benson shouted at her when the door closed. Not a nice man by all accounts. Maybe he just needed more sleep. And so Phil moved towards the front door and very gently set four pints of milk and two choco milks down. He leant over and turned the bottle facing out, just like his dad always did. And then somebody laughed. Phil paused with a finger on the last bottle. His other hand dangled like a mannequin. Oh, the Bensons are up earlier than... Again, somebody laughed, muffled and quiet. And it wasn't coming from the house. He stood up straight and turned, soft soles revolving. A dirty greenhouse came into view just near the pavement. And as soon as he stopped turning, the laughter came again. But this time, this giggle felt different. It was a giggle against something. A laugh into the hand. He pictured Mr. Benson in there, ready to come out striding to hit him with a plant pot. He'd had crazy customers before. It's time to leave. And he took a hasty step towards the path. There were other kinder people to serve after all, and Weetabix tastes like chunks of cardboard without a fresh bottle of help, help me. He froze. That voice, no way was that Mr. Benson. Was that a kid in there? Please. Heart rate rising, Phil took a step toward the greenhouse door and then another, and he whispered, hello? Another giggle, followed by words that weren't the type you'd normally giggle about. Help, help. What if that wasn't laughter? What if the poor little tyke was crying in there? One of the Benson kids, maybe. Maybe Daddy was easy with his fists and this was where his kids liked to hide. Especially when he was so furious at all this overpriced choco milk. So Phil gently set his empty basket down and curled a finger around the cold handle. It was way too dark to see through the grimy glass, so he pulled at the metal frame door. Just one tug brought the whole thing gliding open in a helpfully silent, recently oiled arc. And Phil leant his head into the gloom inside, jaw tight, every filling touching. He couldn't see anybody, just shadows. Where are you? He stepped inside and winced at the smell. He had no clue what alien vegetable was rotting in there, but holy smokes, absolutely stank. He saw a tall, long metal shelving unit along his left, rammed with pots and tools and a hanging piece of tarpaulin. And there was a low wooden table on his right too, and it was filled with herbs sprouting from plastics and plastic pots and carrots and, geez Louise, there were stacks of carrots in here, caked with soil. Come here. The voice, closer now, sent ice sliding down his spine. And he spanned back to see the greenhouse door. The spring hinges had already closed it, so silently that he hadn't noticed. Come here, the voice said. Down here. He squinted towards a low metal shelf where a dark roll of plastic sheeting was hanging from the third shelf, draped down across the second like a curtain, and he knew immediately that this was where the hidden giggler lay. Hey, he whispered, are you okay? Help me out, please. Crikey, that was a kid. He dropped to his knees and slowly reached for the sheet, fingers trembling like they had on his wedding day, getting closer. Take a breath, Phil. Do the right thing. Almost there. And then he snapped his hand back. Yuck. There were slugs crawling around the hem of the canvas, four of them, all bunched up and wriggling together. And then he stroked his throat with a grimace as he watched a very strange thing occur. The slugs started to move in time with one another, and they were working together, tugging at the canvas so it might silently slide down, and it did, and quickly too. It fell into a heap on the floor, and behind it, Phil could see something now visible that both relieved and devastated him all at once. The crying voice was real, not a ghost, not a clever carrot, but what looked like a naked teenage girl, bunched up and lying on her side on the second to bottom shelf, and her long black hair hung from the edge, and her dirty slug fingers were now wriggling across her kneecaps, hugging them towards herself, head folded in. He couldn't see her other hand. "Bloody Nora," he said, oblivious to his breaking the no-whisper policy. And she was a knee-hugging ball. He thought of kids shouting Geronimo when they leapt into the swimming pool, but then thought she was more like a giant embryo instead, because the closer he got, the more he saw her glisten with some sort of gloop. Sweat? Under all that wet, bedraggled black hair, he saw her other hand. She'd splayed it wide across her face. The way he used to play peekaboo with his daughter in the park. And he was so taken aback by this, the splayed hand, that it took him a few seconds to realize that the shivering, wet Geronimo ball was already growing bigger. It was unfurling. He couldn't move. He couldn't speak or even whisper either. He just took off his hat, like a hearse was passing by, and he stared at this bizarre ball of limbs flowering. He whispered in his kindest, most gentlest voice, "I'm gonna put you on my milk float. I'm gonna get you some help." And his absolute best guess was that he'd stumble onto Mr. Benson's prisoner child, like those reports he'd seen of young girls kidnapped and stuffed into cellars for decades. And Phil even had the time to picture himself on the BBC News tonight, the silent, cautious milkman who sneaked a kid to safety and kickstarted a nationwide turn back to doorstep milk deliveries, the hero's option. Until one skinny leg splayed out, then another, and he saw something that didn't compute. Those legs were bizarrely long for a young teen. Like this was one of the Russian contortionists who could dislocate their bodies just to fit inside a tiny box, and the head was still down, and that hair arm strewn hand still clawed across it, but the other arm started peeling away from her knees, the arm folded jaggedly outward. His brain pretended he could hear pencil snapping, but he knew. His ears were filling with the audible cracking and grinding of bones. All this hypnotism stopped when the bare foot hit. It made a steady slap on the concrete floor, and that's when Phil blinked, because the foot had hair on it, and that shoe size was almost as big as his own. With the body still on the shelf, the other foot slapped next to the first, and Phil's gaze rolled up that long, freakishly long leg to see the blossoming of a crotch covered in sticky pubic gloop, and then something else that made him dizzy again. This wasn't a little teen after all, and it certainly wasn't a girl. This was a skinny man, half covered in blood, who had a terrifying ability to fit into tight spaces. One long arm lolled out and started grasping, and Phil went to run, but he couldn't, because when he looked down, his wrist was locked inside those slippery, blood-soaked slug fingers, whose touch had flung his entire body to the coldest peaks of Everest. All he could do was yelp and yank himself free, while this thing, gripping something at last, finally started to fully uncoil. And the other hand, the one under all that hair, finally pulled away, and Phil now saw a face, though he dearly wished he couldn't. It was still at an angle, pushing through the black strands. A brow, a pair of eyes slid through the doorway of the wet fringe, and he saw the grimacing thing being born. A cheek slid and stretched along the shelf toward the edge, and he thought he even saw one tooth grinding a line in the metal. His first thought had been correct. He hadn't heard whimpering or crying at all. The skinny man was giggling like a child. You could hear the cold air of laughter fizzing through the dry lips. And it was the first time Phil made any real unrestricted noise. He wailed loudly, and then he slammed himself back against the wooden table, yanking his clamped wrist as hard as he could. And all that did was drag the naked man fully out so that his horribly long body slid free and dropped. It slapped onto its side on the floor with a nauseating, stomach-turning crunch, and a man-sized beetle, with its limbs flailing out quickly, grabbing the world for balance, was shown. Phil's jawbone lost all strength when the strange skinny man pulled himself up into the upright position, and now fully open, Phil saw everything. But it was the man's stomach, just beneath his belly button, that held the real horror. The most furious cuts and gashes he'd ever seen, like a tire mark, like a pattern, like a word. He saw a word carved into this man's pulsing stomach, a wound word that even now was pumping out fresh fuel for what was becoming a growing, sticky lake on the greenhouse floor. And Phil looked up at the ceiling in panic. The morning sunlight was finally seeping through the grime. When he looked back, he saw the man staring at him, eyes filled with desperate fear, even as he enthusiastically tugged at the ragged word in his belly and laughed. "Let me out," the man mumbled. "Let me out." "Who are you?" "I roam the earth, 133. You want to call someone?" 3-1. "Do you like orange juice? It's fresh." 6-6-6-6. "I'll..." 133, hush, little baby, don't say a word. The man's teeth suddenly snapped at the air and the lips peeled back in an awful bony smile. "Open your mouth, friend." "Why?" "'Cause I'm gonna climb in." Phil yanked as hard as he could. It was on the third grunting pull that he finally dragged his own wrist free, and he heard the wet slide of it, the splashing of drops and the whip of skin pulling, and he grabbed a shelf and pulled himself up, clambering to his feet in a hailstorm of pots and carrots, and when he slammed the greenhouse door open, two of the panes immediately smashed, though Phil wondered if that might have been from the man's roar. Dear God, Phil thought, was there anything ever so loud? "Let me out!" Phil staggered out into a rectangle of light, which wasn't from the sun. It was Mr. Benson's bedroom. He looked up and saw him there, fat, shirtless, and shouting silently at the glass, clawing at the window locks to open up. And Phil just span around and ran. He accidentally kicked his milk basket over the floor and sent it flying. He left it behind. His feet crunched down the gravel path as loud as meteors crashing against the house, and he flung the gate open with a clanging metallic rattle. And he ran straight past the milk van and raced down the street just as the sun was turning the black sky purple and then the purple sky pink. And gasping and wheezing but refusing to stop, he saw the other streetlights flickering on as the day began. And he saw many people at their windows holding the curtains back and wondering what Mr. Benson was shouting about and why on earth the milkman was running down the street screaming. And why, somewhere amongst it all, a strange and not right voice could also be heard wailing and crying and laughing all at the same time.
Oh, Johnny, I see the bloke in his white shirt. His Hawaiian shirt. He's pointing his watch, but I am enjoying this conversation, really.
Me too. So what are we going to do?
I think we need to get out of here, but I think we need to, for today, but I think we need to resume next time, really.
Yeah, okay, so we could do part two next time, yeah.
Yeah, and everyone just come and listen in and see how the conversation ends.
Yeah, and in the meantime, why not check out all reputable booksellers and online sellers and get yourself some Peter Law's books ready for the next show.
And for today, thank you, Peter, for joining us, and we'll hear more from you next time.